The reading today is called The Low Road by Marge Piercy. What can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up, they can bust you, they can break your fingers, they can burn your brain with electricity, blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember. They can take your child, wall up your lover. They can do anything you can't stop them from doing. How can you stop them? Alone, you can fight. You can refuse. You can take what revenge you can, but they roll over you. But two people, fighting back to back, can cut through a mob. A snake dancing file can break a cordon. An army can meet an army. Two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With four, you can play bridge and start an organization. With six, you can rent a whole house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. A dozen make a demonstration. 100 fill a hall. 1,000 have solidarity and your own newsletter. 10,000, power and your own paper. 100,000, your own media. 10 million, your own country. It goes on, one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they said no. It starts when you say we and know who you mean. And each day you mean one more. As I'm sure you've heard many times this summer, from other people who have spoken, the theme of this summer's series of talks is what would be in your Bible if you decided to create one. Well, right up front, I will be honest and admit that I have not kept readings or poems or other spiritually meaningful material in a loose-leaf notebook or in a file folder or even shoved in a desk drawer. But I have kept a virtual Bible. I've kept it in the hard drive in my brain since I was very young. So preparing for today, I went through it, did some disk cleanup, and suddenly realized that I had filled my Bible with a very limited range of topics. I found one medium-sized file labeled Mystery and Wonder. It was full of those things I have experienced in life that I have no answer for, like how did the universe come into existence? Is there a God? Or things that evoked awe and wonder, like the Grand Canyon. Then I found another file about the same size labeled Reason and Science. I'm sure you can picture what's in that. Facts, not beliefs or guesses or wishes or theories or urban legends. But by far, the largest file I found, many, 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 many gigabytes in size, says it contains words and deeds of prophets. Now, this label may sound familiar to some of you, as coincidentally, one of the six sources that Unitarian Universalism draws from to support our beliefs and principles is, quote, words and deeds of prophetic women and men which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. Prophets. Do we have prophets? All I can think of is those old men in the Old Testament dressed in long robes who got messages straight from God and went about exhorting everyone to listen and do something. Usually change their evil ways or else. Prophets like Noah or Amos or Jonah. Now, Jonah lived in the city of Nineveh, which had grown wealthy from warring on its neighbors, causing them much suffering. God became concerned that they had descended into wickedness, so he whispered in Jonah's ear. He said, Jonah, Get out there and tell them to wake up and stop their evil ways, or I will destroy Nineveh. So Jonah spread the word. Hey, listen, you guys. If you keep on, in 40 days, Nineveh shall be overthrown. The people listened to Jonah, turned away from their evil ways, and proclaimed a fast and put on sackcloth to show God they had repented. God saw what they did and did not punish them. A very successful prophet. Well, there have been prophetic men and women walking among us and raising their voices throughout human history, even if they have not been officially labeled prophets or included in one of the world religion's holy books. Unitarian Universalism believes in the ability and even responsibility of all of us to be prophets. The Reverend James Luther Adams, a longtime UU minister, a professor of Christian ethics at Harvard, and one of our religion's most influential thinkers, wrote, "The prophetic liberal church is the church in which all the members share the common responsibility to attempt to foresee the consequences of human behavior, both individual and institutional, with the intention of making history in place of merely being pushed around by it. Only through the prophetism of all believers can we together foresee doom and mend our common ways." Well, my Bible, my virtual Bible, is a living document where prophetic voices are included as I hear them. And that is why the file labeled Words and Deeds of Prophets is the largest one. As I went through the file, I downloaded a few favorite items that keep inspiring and guiding me to share with you today. Prophets you may not have heard of. The oldest document I found is the story of the Good Samaritan, the story told by Jesus. I was told that story as a 5-year-old in Sunday school, complete with a picture to color, and I remember it like it is today. I remember the picture. I remember coloring it. It made such an impact on me. As an adult, I learned that not all words and deeds in the Christian Bible are what Jesus really said or really did. But this is one theologians pretty much agree upon. Jesus probably said many times the exact words, "Love your enemies," and may have said it as it is recorded in the book of Luke, "Love your enemies as well as your neighbors," which is the story of the Good Samaritan. The lesson of the story I was taught is that each individual has worth and value. The person on the other side is just as worthy of justice as you are. When you imagine yourself in the shoes of that other person, he or she must have the same level of humanity, dignity, and sense of fairness as you would want. And this transcends divisions of class, status, or race. This appealed to me even as a child, as a good way to live. The second item I put into my mental Bible about the same time was a fable read to me then. Now, the prophet here is a little different from Jesus. The prophet to me was the little red hen. In this tale, if you don't remember it, the little red hen finds a grain of wheat and asks for help from the other farmyard animals to plant it. However, no animal will volunteer to help her. At each further stage, harvesting, threshing, milling, baking the flour into bread, the hen again asks for help from the other animals. But again, she gets no assistance. Now here comes the or else part. Finally, the hen has completed her task. and asks who will help her eat the bread. All the previous non-participants eagerly volunteer to eat the bread, and she says, "Forget it." She eats it with her chicks, leaving none for anyone else. It fits the prophet model for me: change your evil ways or be punished. And I took it then as an example of fairness. As a child, it meant fairness to me that we all need to work together as a group or as a community. We all need to contribute. We'll all have the reward from doing that. At that point in my life, a great thing happened. I learned to read and got a library card. My sister took me to the library at least twice a week. There was no TV in those days. Once we even got turned away because we came too often. Libraries were different. And I soon learned what I wanted to read was books about people. Real people. People in other cultures and countries. People who wanted to change the world or had changed the world. People who fought injustices. This library had a large set of biographies, which I think in those days and maybe after, all libraries did. They all had orange covers. They're all the same. They just had the name of a person on them. And I loved them. One of them that I remember was about a woman named Dorothea Dix, a Unitarian who lived in Massachusetts. In 1830, she visited a local jail to do a Sunday school sermon for female inmates. She found that criminals and the mentally ill all lived together in terrible, unheated conditions. When she asked why, she was told the insane do not feel heat or cold. She immediately began a radical campaign to stop treating mental illness as a crime. She went to court to get conditions improved, and she won. Then she went to the state legislature and convinced them that mentally ill people were not criminals. She succeeded in Massachusetts, but didn't stop there. She went to more states. Then she went to the U.S. Congress to lobby for federal oversight. She went to Europe and did the same thing there. Her work resulted in taking mental health patients out of jails and putting them in hospitals. Now, this was not as easy as it may sound. It's successful now, but then, remember, it was the 1800s. She was a woman. She was unmarried. She had little money or support. She met with phenomenal opposition everywhere. The New Jersey legislature even passed a resolution providing $100 for a one-way train ticket to, quote, get Miss Dix across the Delaware River and out of this state. She changed the way society thought about the mentally ill, as well as improving the conditions they lived in. She saw a problem, she stood up, she took action, she made people listen. Another woman who saw a problem and spoke up and made a difference in the way society looks at a controversial issue was Rachel Carson. Rachel Carson is a biologist, and she was in desperate need of a job during the Depression. So she went to work for the federal government at what became the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Carson's first choice for a degree had been English, so she was given the task to write brochures and newspaper articles that would make nature and conservation understandable to the public. She became well known for this and was able to become a full-time writer in the 1950s. In the 1940s, while still at the federal government, she became concerned with the use of synthetic pesticides. But it was the U.S. federal government's 1957 gypsy moth eradication program that prompted Carson to devote her research to pesticides and environmental poisons. The Washington, D.C. chapter of the Audubon Society actively opposed such spraying programs and recruited her to help make public the government's existing spraying practices and the related research around them. Carson began a 4-year project of what would become her famous book, Silent Spring. Man's attitude toward nature, she said, is today critically important simply because we have acquired the power to alter and destroy it. President Kennedy saw the writing on the wall and passed new public policies aimed at protecting human health and the environment. Her book and these policies were extremely controversial at the time. I can remember them. One critic wrote, "We can live without birds and animals, but we cannot live without business." To the chemical industry, she had to be stopped, and she was vilified by many, called a communist, a fanatic defender of the cult of the balance of nature. Even though today some of her theories about the severity of the relationship between DDT and cancer may be slightly wrong, her work and the activism it's inspired are at least partly responsible for the environmental movement in this country. It changed the way people view the natural world and the importance of it. Another document I found in my folder has the label simply, "The Citizens of Denmark, 1943. Denmark was occupied by the Germans in 1940, but unlike the rest of Europe, there were no harsh regulations imposed at that time. For a number of years, the Jewish community continued to function as usual. However, in August 1943, things changed. Germany grew tired of Danish resistance and imposed strict military control. And on October 1st of that year, Hitler ordered the Danish Jews to be arrested and deported to concentration camps. However, the Danes found out about it, and with the encouragement of their king, thousands and thousands of citizens launched a national rescue mission, hiding the Danish Jews for several days in their homes, then smuggling them onto boats of all sizes and kinds and ferrying them across to safety in Sweden. They managed to evacuate over 7,000 of Denmark's 7,800 Jews. Many people have looked back at this and wondered, why did this happen in Denmark? And they think it's because Danes regarded their Jewish neighbors, they regarded everyone in their country as Danes first. There was no us and them, it was just us. This prophetic deed happened because of the realization that they had a shared commitment to democracy and law rather than to race and religion. As the poem said, thousands of people have solidarity and power. Recently, it's only a few weeks ago, I put into my folder the obituary for Dr. Donald Rasmussen, who often said, "I was just doing my job." "I was just doing my job," he said when asked about his life's mission to aid coal miners. Dr. Rasmussen, as a new doctor, opened a medical practice in 1962 in Beckley, West Virginia, and soon realized there was something terribly wrong going on there. Vast numbers of his patients had severe lung disease. Throughout the 1960s, Rasmussen became involved in groundbreaking research about black lung, a sometimes fatal disease that afflicted almost 70% of coal miners. It's caused by inhaling coal dust. He got involved at first by simply writing reports for some miners for Social Security disability or workman's compensation claims. It had been next to impossible before this for any miners to win these claims and to receive these benefits. Rasmussen served as an expert witness before state and federal judges. He met with coal officials, coal operators, miners, lawmakers, and he even went to Washington in 1968 to testify before a congressional subcommittee. "I was invited to testify," he said. "That was the first time I did any advocacy work, trying to explain to congressmen the problems miners were having." The coal companies hired doctors to dispute Rasmussen's research and findings. "I wasn't trying to make anyone mad. I was just doing my duty as a doctor, which is to take care of my patients in whatever capacity needed." Work by Rasmussen and others led to the passage of the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act, which established standards for coal dust in the mines and led to a significant decrease in the number and severity of black lung cases until today. At 90 years old, he was concerned again. "The current mining machines are so much more powerful than the old ones," he said. "They can mine coal with a lot of layers of rock. The power releases a lot of coal dust and a silica too, and the more silica in the dust, the more toxic it is." He died last month. There is no mention in the obituary of anyone taking up the cause in Dr. Rasmussen's place. Prophetic words and deeds don't come from just old men and old women. Sometimes you have to listen to children and the youth. A young girl from Pakistan is making her voice heard around the world. As a schoolgirl, Malala Yousafzai survived being shot in the head by the Taliban for just attending school. But she would not be silenced, and she has gone on to become an advocate for human rights, women's rights, and the right to education for all. At the United Nations in July, she brought the General Assembly to its feet, saying, "One child, one teacher, one pen, and one book can change the world." She wants all women, but particularly women being oppressed around the world, to understand. "Women are strong," she says. "Women can do anything. Come out and struggle for your rights. Nothing can happen without your voice. Do not wait for me to do something for your rights. It's your world." Believe it or not, if you know me, I have kind of an odd one in my file. Even in the current contentious political environment, there are a few politicians who will still speak the truth at a cost to themselves. Have you ever heard of Republican Bob Inglis from South Carolina? As a member of the House Science Committee, he initially opposed efforts to address climate change. But the scientists that came and testified at his committee and his five children changed his views, and he began advocating for a carbon tax, taxes from a Republican, to reduce dependence on fossil fuels. In Washington and South Carolina, Inglis's acknowledgement of the scientific reality of climate change drew intense criticism from within the Republican Party. He kept arguing and trying to convince his conservative colleagues that they should go with the facts, the science, accept the National Academy of Sciences' conclusion that climate change is caused by human activities and poses significant risks. Did they listen? No. But they did make sure he lost his next election and would never be able to run for any office again. So, did he quit? No, in July of 2012, he launched the Energy and Enterprise Initiative to promote conservative and free enterprise solutions to energy and climate challenges. He is the most recent recipient of the Kennedy Profiles in Courage Award. Some of the most powerful prophetic messages have been communicated to us not by the spoken word, but through music. Who can deny what an inspiring force the spiritual "We Shall Overcome" was in the civil rights movement? People responded and were strengthened in their resolve to fight legal and societal injustices. This song has been sung not just in the United States. It was taken up in North Korea, in Beirut, in Tiananmen Square, in South Africa. "We Shall Overcome" began as a slave work song. That original was adopted, revised, and popularized in the early 1950s by another Unitarian, Pete Seeger. Pete Seeger believed in the power of song. He liked to quote Plato, "Rulers should be careful about what songs are allowed to be sung." Pete Seeger lived a long life of confronting powers and structures of evil and corruption, using song to spread the message of progressive causes, including workers' rights, civil rights, nuclear disarmament, and environmentalism. One of his most well-known songs, one that he actually wrote, talks about the cycle of history and how we humans keep repeating the same destructive behavior over and over again. I think because we don't listen to our prophets, we keep doing it. I've asked Christopher Darcy to sing this prophetic song for us today. I'm sure you know it. You might want to sing along if he allows you. And I think it is particularly relevant today, while this country is in the midst of a debate about should we give conflict resolution a try first before we go directly to armed conflict, as we talk about the Iran treaty. Christopher.
I've asked a few of our congregants to join us. Come join me now, please. And as Leslie has so kindly said, you're all welcome to sing along. I should know it. Maybe you'll need to answer the question again.
Where have all the flowers gone?
Barbara, Jerry. I think it is good and edifying to save the prophetic words and deeds that inspire you and challenge you in your loose-leaf Bible, whether it's in an actual notebook or in your brain. Keep them there where you will see them often. Perhaps they will embolden you to step up and make a difference. Each of us can offer prophetic words and deeds. They do not have to be grand. Right here in Loudoun County, all of us, witnessed someone we know see a need for bus shelters in Leesburg and step up and make it happen. A local high school girl a few years ago learned of the need for clean water for wells in a faraway African country, and she stepped up and has now raised over $300,000 through an annual walk for water at Morven Park. And you don't have to do it alone. Find another person to keep you sane and give you support, or maybe four to start an organization, or better yet, a dozen to make a demonstration. In the words of the prophet Micah, "And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, and to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God as you define your God?" May it be so.